Before I get started, Phyllis talked about the excitement of her first convention. I left my first convention after the first meeting because I hurt too badly to stay with 300 people. Aware of the fact that you might be here excited or you might be here scared, if you're Al-Anon or AA and here for your first AA convention, would you stand so that we may make you feel welcome? If you're here tomorrow morning, you're healthier than I was. There's a town in England that had a wisdom that, boy, we could have profited from in the United States. 75 years ago, they foresaw the environmental crises we're still trying to walk through now. And they saw very quickly that the main threat to their whole living standard was the combustion engine and the danger it would do to the quality of their air. So they had a town meeting and banned it instantly. Nothing with a combustion engine has ever been allowed in that town from that date on, whether you live there or just are a tourist. No car, no bus, no truck, no cycle, nothing. Their problem was, having banned this, what would they use for transportation for themselves and all of their goods? And back and forth all day they went on the pros and cons of the different things they could use until at the end of the day, by a close vote, they've settled on that which they have abided by for 75 years. They settled on the donkey, which has held, therefore, a crucial part in the life of this town because it's the only means of transportation. So should you ever visit there and look carefully enough, you will see that the most senior man in town has his own ass. The youngest lady in town has her own ass. And because they need them so much, people are pushing their ass and pushing their ass and pushing their ass. You may not have thought about it, but any time somebody pushes their ass too hard, it's likely to break down on them, which can lead to some severe complications. Problems quickly start piling up. Now, in order to avoid this catastrophe, the natural thing to do is borrow somebody else's ass. In your whole life, has anyone else's ass ever moved fast enough for you? Well, the solution to that is very simple. You help it along. Unfortunately, people don't like to have their ass kicked in public by others, and that leads to a lot of difficulties. Important as life is, centering around the ass, once a year everybody parades their ass in public. Now, you may not have studied asses very much, but they are not all the same. And they are really holding a contest to pick the best looking ass in town. Asses may differ, but politicians don't. And the day of the contest, you find the local mayor kissing ass for votes. Come Sunday morning, of course, everybody hauls their ass off to go to church. Now, there's a particular Sunday that underlies my sharing, and right in the midst of the Catholic Mass, an earthquake hit the town. Well, of course, everybody ran out of church to save their ass, except for the priest. He had parked his ass, tying it to some trees along the side of the church, and he noticed that the windows there were broken. And he thought very intelligently he would jump through the window and land on his ass. What he didn't know was that's precisely where the main crevice of the earthquake was, and he fell in it by error, proving even a priest can't tell his ass from a hole in the ground. I'm Larry Kowalski, and I'm an alcoholic. And I happen to be a Catholic priest who got here because I couldn't tell my ass from a hole in the ground. I still am, and people occasionally will ask about this, and I don't have much time to go into it. I am a Catholic priest for the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. I hope the opening story offended no one. My God has a sense of humor and is not offended by vocabulary that doesn't intentionally harm or hurt anybody. I use regular dress and I don't use a title because first, when I sobered up, we had a Colonel John in the group where I was who got drunk. And he came back as John, and I hope I've learned his lesson. Anything that separates me from the fellowship can kill me. And so should you be a devout member of some church and want to honor the title that I have, please don't use it on me in the fellowship, because it can kill me. There's a much more important reason that I would like to share with you, if I don't forget it a little bit later in my talk. I'm going to give a serious talk tonight, because it's where I'm at. About 3-4 years ago, I grew up in the mountains of Pennsylvania. Did I give my sobriety date? Because of the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary or desirable to take a drink or a mood-changing chemical today, or any today since May the 21st, 1972. My home group is the Open Door Group in Lawton, Oklahoma. I have committed myself to attend meetings there Saturday at noon, Monday at noon, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Two of those dates, because of duties in the parish, I can't often precisely define which of the 3 days I'll make two meetings. So I make a total of 4 home meetings. I have been committed to 4 meetings of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for approximately the last 18 years, and it's a program that works well for me. Because I grew up in mountains, I love mountains, and about 3 or 4 summers ago, I was in Aspen. And I walked up to the top of Aspen Mountain, and I do not know flowers, and it's gonna be, one of the flowers is gonna be important to the way I'm gonna organize my sharing with you. And I saw a field of what I thought was, and still think was, wild dandelions. And as a field on a mountaintop, they were stunningly beautiful. And I came up with this little vision for myself of my God planting a garden with different kinds of flowers, with different kinds of shapes, making an overall pattern like a jigsaw puzzle, and getting down to one little corner and wanting a flower there to complete the picture and balance it off, that wouldn't be yellow and that wouldn't be gold, but would be in between them both, that would be about 2 or 3 inches tall, that would have petals, and that would just open up and bloom. And he created the dandelion to complete his puzzle. But people looked at that flower that God made, and they labeled it a weed. And they've tried to root it out of their lives. And I tried to just picture what it would be like for me to be a dandelion at the moment of budding and feeling that the world did not want me to be yellowish golden and trying to open up red instead. That the world didn't want me to be 2 to 3 inches high and to try to be as tall as a tulip instead. That the world didn't want me to have either no odor or the odor of a dandelion and trying to be a lilac instead. That the world didn't want me to kind of have the petals that a dandelion has and have instead the shape of a rose. With the strain and the pain of my trying not to be who I was and trying to become something other than I am. I've had the honor of hearing hundreds of fifth steps in both of our fellowships. And we don't all fit the same molds. Many of us in this room feel we belong. Many of us in this room grew up feeling like dandelions, afraid and ashamed to be what we are, unable to bud and become ourselves, and striving to be anything other than what we were. And I very clearly fall in that group. I showed Phyllis a picture before I began of me at the age of 7. And my ears stood straight out, and they were about this big in proportion to my head today. I was called Big Ears, I was called Dumbo, and I was hurt again and again and again. And it was just part of the physical pain that I experienced. And 10 years sober, I'm 56 years old right now. No, I'm not. I'm 55 and 364 days. When I was young, I was just made to feel so ugly. My mother would call me Big Ears in hate to hurt me when she exploded. Kids in school called me Big Ears and Dunbo. So that 10 years sober and 46 years old or so, I was unable to picture my own face in my own mind. I had never pictured it. When I shaved, I blocked out what I looked like in the mirror because that was ugly. When I found the picture that I showed Phyllis, and she said, "What did you do?" when she saw it. People asked me, "When did you have plastic surgery?" And I never did. And I have no idea when I grew into my ears, because when I shaved and looked in a mirror, I blocked out what I saw. I was ugly, and almost every one of you had a different color. And somehow I didn't want to be the color of Big Ears, and I didn't know a single thing that I could do not to have big ears. I realize today my mother had heavy emotional problems, and she didn't want me to have feelings. At the age of 55, I was absolutely unaware of ever having a single memory of crying in my life. But I remembered my mother saying, "You cry and I'll give you something to cry for." I knew at that time that I had 55 years of pain like a river of sorrow waiting to come out someday. But I didn't have the right to feel my sorrow. I didn't have the right to cry for my sorrow. And at the same time, I didn't have any right to be overly happy. At about, or maybe about 5-6 years ago, when I started really becoming aware of much of what was happening, I was at a conference, and a group of people at the conference were just free, and they were just acting up somewhere, and I looked at them and snorted inside myself, and I said, "That's childish." And I instantly said to myself, "And wouldn't you do anything to be free like them right now, to let your child be free and not have that damn governor put on the feelings where you can't feel? And if the dandelion can't open up and be itself, there's no way that it's really going to stop." And yet I couldn't have my feelings, good or bad. I could think academically, but I was never, ever allowed to feel that any practical thought that I had was right. And so today, it's a major accomplishment if I get a screwdriver and change the outside bracket for a socket in a wall. But for years, I wasn't allowed to think through any single solution. Anything I thought of was no good. I realized through some help that others have given me recently that very, very sadly, through a sort of coincidences of life, I was absolutely emotionally abandoned in life. Nobody gave a damn if I existed but one friend of my mother's. And I cried inside for anybody to pay attention to me, to want me. And since if you hated me, that meant I was important. I was unimportant enough to dislike. I watched about 10 years ago the Charlie Brown special on Valentine's Day. And I've seen it once in my life, and I don't think I'll ever have the strength to watch it again. Because I lived the pain of going out to the mailbox with a satchel and getting no Valentines. And it wasn't because anybody disliked me in school. It was because nobody gave a damn. And nobody ever taught me how to live. Nobody taught me how to bud. My grandparents were all born in Europe. My dad was a coal miner. I had nobody my age in my neighborhood. Nobody has ever taught me to throw a baseball, a football, or a basketball, but I carry a tape in my head that I got from my mother also that says, anything I do, I've got to do perfectly, and even then I'm not good enough. So if I can't do it, I won't try it. I threw a football when I was about 7 years old when nobody was watching, and it wobbled. And I knew footballs weren't supposed to wobble. I never threw another football till I was about 40 years old, and that sucker just sailed. And I was lividly angry that I'd wasted all those years. Nobody ever taught me how to throw a baseball or a softball. I don't ever remember throwing any. See, I was 5 in September, in July, and started first grade in September, so I was younger than anybody else in school, and I went to a Catholic school, and I wasn't picked for sports. We didn't have organized sports in this Catholic school. We just got together. Nobody wanted me. And I just felt like a total reject, not belonging at all. At the age of about 18 months, I was sexually molested by my mother, and the effects of that molestation has affected my entire life. At the age of about 13, she added on a negative molesting, making me feel that every single thing that I am sexually is dirty, ugly, and sinful. And it's like part of me, the petals, are sinful. And that's an integral part of me. And I was simply not right for this world, and it looked as somehow as if all of you belong. The God that I had as I grew up was a God who would damn me for anything and certainly didn't want me in the world. And in just every single thing I had, I just didn't belong. I was a dandelion and you were roses. You were lilacs. You were tulips. And I wanted to be like you and I didn't know how. And I wanted to belong and I had no idea at all how to do it. There's no way big ears disappear without plastic surgery, and coal miners don't dream that way. There's no way that feelings that can't be felt can be felt in the background that I had. There's no way that someone that life is ignoring can feel a part of life. I didn't have a friend until I hit college. Just absolutely ignored by life. The greatest thing that happened to me happened at the age of 16, and it's probably why I'm still alive. I found alcohol and I started drinking. And I was instantly alcoholic. And I pity people who are social drinkers. Just suppose you are like me and feel totally wrong for life and you take a drink and nothing happens. And the wonder of my life is I was a dandelion who took a drink and belonged. Now, I never felt attractive. But I felt there was a glow inside. It's almost as if my color was so nice, you wouldn't know that I was the wrong flower. I could feel my feelings. I could be happy. I was the kind of person I think you would want at your parties when I started drinking. I was fun. I was the life of the party. My whole positive side was free to be. I could be a little child. I could be free. I could be me. Later on in my drinking, the negative side came out, and I think that too was very necessary to keep me alive today. In blackouts, I could just dump all the guilt and the fear and the self-hatred that I was carrying in every other way. I drank and I felt a part of life. I started drinking at the age of 16 in a bar in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, the town where I grew up. And I remember that bar. And a real great miracle was, as I told you, I didn't feel ugly. I could feel my feelings. I didn't feel damned. And I didn't feel abandoned. There's only two groups that I've ever fully felt a part of in my whole life. I didn't in my family. I did feel a part of the first group I drank with in that bar. I was not on the outside trying to belong to that group. I belonged. And alcohol did that. And I believe, therefore, it kept me alive. And it gave me the strength to go on and blossom and become much of what I am today rather than cracking up. It allowed me to go through college. I have 10 years of college, quite successful. And I think it was alcohol taking the tap off the pain, allowing me to be whatever I could be, that allowed me to do that. I got an insight into that from a speaker at our own state convention who said that alcohol was the cure for her alcoholism. And it certainly was for mine. I belonged in the garden of life. I graduated from high school and started 4 years at the Pennsylvania State University, commonly known to some people at Penn State, and I just have a tremendous love for Penn State. I graduated from Penn State at the age of 20 at a time when the minimum drinking age in Pennsylvania was 21. I was never able to drink legally in my own college days, the undergraduate days. About 4 years ago, I was driving to give an AA talk, and I started thinking about my life, and something stunned me. In my 10 or 11 years of college, when I started thinking, the only memories I have are memories of drinking. I had some great honors at Penn State. I will tell you this, I had the honor, only one person per college did this when I graduated, received the diploma directly from the university's president while everybody else got it later from a dean. Because of my academic grades, I had the honor of being on the field and graduating for the College of Liberal Arts and getting my diploma direct. I received 9 fellowship offers as I graduated from Penn State, and I had the honor of being elected Phi Beta Kappa in about 8 other honorary societies. I'm telling you that simply to tell you I don't remember any of that. I remember every fraternity party I was able to go to and drink and get drunk. I graduated from Penn State, and I went to the University of Wisconsin to start graduate school. And the only thing I remember about the University of Wisconsin is that's the first place where I could start legally drinking. I could tell you where the bar was in Madison where I started the drinking, how beautiful those steins of legal beer were, and how great the wine coolers that I discovered were. And I went through the rest of my academic life, and the memories I remember are memories connected to drinking. And it occurred to me that social drinkers, going back over their life, don't just peg memories to those moments. But you see, I've told you enough for me to understand why those are the moments I remember. Because every other moment, the moments when it seemed like I was getting honors, I was a dandelion, a weed in a world that didn't want me. But the times I had alcohol in my system, I was okay, I belonged, and my mind can claim those memories and say, I was okay, I belonged, Larry was good. And that's why I remember them. One semester into Wisconsin, I decided to study for the priesthood, and I went to the University of Loyola in Chicago. The only thing I can tell you about a semester in Chicago is directly across the street from my room was a liquor store where I bought bottles of wine and kept them on my ledge through the Chicago winter to keep me alive. And then I went into the seminary through the old system of the Catholic Church, where if we had a drop to drink, they would throw us out from September to June. And again, I had a lot of honors. I led my class in what was supposed to be the most distinguished Catholic seminary in the United States. I led my class for 6 years academically. I don't remember that, and I don't remember the other honors. About 5 times a year, they let us loose, besides Christmas and Easter. And on those dates, if we drank a drop, they would throw us out. And I came in drunk every time, and those are the memories I remember because I was still okay. After 6 years in the seminary, I was asked to leave for emotional problems, and I taught in a high school in Baltimore, and life really began because I started drinking all the time, legally. I started drinking to handle the pain inside, and I felt good. And I remember much of that time, even though in one area, for being asked to leave the seminary, I carried a deep scar. But the alcohol worked, and I didn't give a hoot that I would wake up in blackouts. I didn't give a hoot about not having control. I didn't want control. Why control something that will keep me a weed when drinking it makes me a flower? And I couldn't live as a weed. And I enjoyed being a flower. I finished 3 years in Baltimore teaching, and I came to Oklahoma to prepare to study for the seminary. I then went back into the seminary, and in the 4 years I was out, the Catholic Church had done its total change. And it was a whole new world. Remember I told you, have a drop to drink and get thrown out in old seminary? I walked into the new seminary, and we had a recreation room, and there was a Coke machine, and right next to it was a beer machine. Quarters for big bottles of beer. And I was home. I had a car. I could drive off campus and drink anyway. But I would be in that rec room. Now, they didn't run the beer machine all the time. They would only do it during certain recreational hours. I would be in there an hour before the recreational hours began because I would be waiting to become me. I know that today. I didn't see it back then. When I was ordained a priest, my alcoholism exploded. I heard a lot of fifth steps, as if I told you, and I've heard enough to know there is no single trait that is universal for all alcoholics. I've listened to solid fifth steps of alcoholics who have never lied, who have never stolen. I've listened to some who never drank commercial alcohol. I'm one who absolutely never worried about my wine supply, my liquor supply, because I ordered the church wine. And we always had 52 gallons of wine Now, I wasn't the boss, and my pastor picked a wine I didn't like. But many mornings at 3 o'clock in the morning, when everything else was gone, and I went desperately looking for another drink to be me, I would go over, get the key, go over to the church basement, and come back with a gallon of wine, and life continued. I didn't really hide my liquor like Joe Martin in the same profession. I hid my empties. My empty liquor bottles, and about 2 or 3 times a week at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I would creep out, and this is true, I would put my empty liquor bottles in the nun's dumpster. I didn't want the garbage men to think we were doing so much drinking in the rectory, which is what we call the place where priests live. But about that time, alcohol stopped working. And the way I saw that was where I drank. Alcohol, as I told you, made me social. It put me with you. I drank in a place called the Purple Bunny Club in Lawton, Oklahoma. I drank there for a good reason. This was during Vietnam, and many, many people were coming home cursed, really crippled with pain, and they needed counseling. That much was honest, and I was one of the more liberal people in town, and they could talk with me. That still was true. Now, in my mind, I thought they would be very, very uncomfortable talking in a parish house, but they would feel very loose, shouting their problems at me in the Purple Bunny Club over the sets of music. Now, naturally, they bought the drinks. I mean, that went without tell. But that's where my drinking was. I drank to be social, to be part of the flower bed of life. But all of a sudden, I wasn't drinking out. I was drinking home. And then I was drinking upstairs. And then I was drinking upstairs with the doors closed and the shades down. And I had a friend who went further. She ended up her drinking in the closet with the light out and the door closed in the fetal position. And I understand that. It's like I opened up, alcohol had stopped working, and I had to go back into the bud to hide what I was from you. And I felt dirtier drunk than I did sober. I was dumping my guilt in blackouts. I felt lonelier drunk than I did sober. I felt crazier drunk than I did sober. I felt uglier physically drunk than I did sober. And I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stay stopped. And that was real hell. Now I hear and I talk to a lot of Al-Anons. The Al-Anons, because of my profession, normally come to me first. Because everybody in my parish knows I'm an alcoholic. And the Al-Anons want the alcoholic to stop, and they think that's when life begins. I know today the worst thing that could have happened in my life would be for you to have given me what I came to AA for, simply to get me to stop drinking 21 years ago, to put me in a straitjacket, and that's all that would have happened. Because then I would have remained a dandelion, unable to open, hating what I was, and fearing anything that I would ever become. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that is designed to allow me to be me and to discover that I belong in my God's world and that I have a part in my world and I belong to your world. The way I like to put this looking ahead is, until I want me as much in my world as my God wants me in his world, I don't really understand who I am. And until I love me, as Larry, in my own heart, as much as my God, I've discovered, loves me in his heart, I really don't truly yet know where I belong in this world. And I found all of that as a priest through Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came here, I had become an atheist. I don't have time to say this, but I stole every cent in the poor fund of my first church for a 3-year period. And it wasn't for alcohol or drugs. I used drugs as a backup. It was to finance other problems that I had that helped in little ways to distract me from the pain of being me. I've got to be able to be Larry. And the interesting thing is, in order to be able to be Larry, the most important thing for me is to remember that I'm an alcoholic. If I put any problem in my world, my color, my shape, my size, over the reality of being alcoholic, I will not this day be allowed to come to peace with myself. And I have to work 21 years sober now at times to really remember that I'm as powerless today as I was 21 years ago, 22 years ago when I was still drinking. And I'm very grateful for whatever happens in my world to bring me back to the single reality that discovering who I am first depends upon my remembering today what I am. I want to share with you a few of the powerful meetings I've been at. Probably one of the five best meetings I ever attended was a meeting in which very small AA group, and 5 feet away from the table where we met was the restroom, and in that restroom was an alcoholic woman at her second meeting, and all through our meeting for 60 minutes she was in there having the dry heaves. She 12-stepped me and almost everybody else there as solidly as it's ever happened before. This year, very sadly, 2 people that I sponsor in other fellowships in NA have twisted off, one with 17 years and one with 18 years. They have reminded me I only have today. And both of them had superb programs at one time with unbelievable peace and deep God experiences. I had to face many, many problems in my life, in my sobriety. If I put those problems first, ultimately I will forget who I am, and I'm never going to allow to be who I am. So I've got to remember today the single most important thing in my life is I just don't drink. And I'm powerless over that, and I need a power other than me to stand between me and alcohol. In order for me to really live at peace, the second step is so crucial. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Please, those of you who are newer, don't limit that to sobriety. That isn't what the step says. I told you that if all you gave me 21 years ago was sobriety, it would have been what I would have wanted. But the pain then of 21 years of discovering and being just a dandelion and unable to come to peace with that would have wiped me out. I have to believe today that regardless of any defect I have, God has a power strong enough that I'm going to be able to love everything that I am. Someday, if not today. That God's power is stronger than my weakness. And that's the challenge of the second step. It begins with sobriety, because if I'm drinking, I know I cannot love or like myself. But just being sober isn't enough for me, because I sober up to pain, the pain of being me. And I was 12 years sober and discovered I've never had a relationship in my life. I've manipulated people, and I've allowed people to manipulate me. But I didn't have the maturity to really relate with another person. And I began wondering, 12 years sober and 47 years old, is there any hope? And that's one of the few times that the second step has been so crucially important in my life. I'm going to jump ahead and tell you that the same thing came true when I realized I've never cried. And I knew that someday the tears would come out. And I started praying for the gift of tears, and I would choke up at times in public during sermons talking about love or in AA meetings. And I never wanted to cry publicly, so I'd say quickly, "Not now, God, later." And the pain stayed inside. And about 5 months ago, I had a two-year-old dog, about 3 pounds, a toy fox terrier runt, that just was everything to me. And she had developed painful tumors in her back, and I took her to a vet to be put to sleep and walked out and sobbed. And it was so good because I had the right to cry, the right to be me, the right to feel pain, and the right to share the pain because I told people about it in church so that others could have the same hope. I believe that God's powers are stronger than my weaknesses, and I will be able to be me. But I can't become me just by myself. I have to turn my life and my will not over to God, but to the care of God. God's care is going to take care of my unfolding, my blossoming, my becoming a dandelion in full flower in right season. And my God came into my life through a sponsor. I told you I was an atheist when I came to the program. I didn't want there to be a God. I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in AA. I believed in 2 people. And they brought me to a meeting, and I listened. And then I believed in the meeting. And then I believed in the program. And then I woke up to a peace I never knew existed. And I have continued to find my peace by turning my life and my will over to the care of God. For me, that's my sponsor, and I've had the same sponsor for 18 years. And he's not gentle with me. My sponsor never went to college. My sponsor had never been a Christian till 3 years ago. And when he converted, I got afraid he'd become one of these fanatics and ram the Bible down my throat. For 21 years, I'm for 18 years, any problem I've ever taken to him, he's given me the answer. And if I do what he tells me, that answer works for me. I'm in coat and tie tonight, and I told Phyllis this, because 10 years sober, I spoke in my sponsor's group. And I'm a compulsive overeater, and I was down to the thinnest weight I have ever been through working another program. And I was so proud of what God had done for me, I wanted to show it in jeans and a t-shirt. And my sponsor thinks that you honor AA by putting coat and tie on behind the podium. 10 years sober, he literally threw me against the wall and told me I was to wear coat and tie. I'm going to quickly walk through a little aside with another fellowship. About 5 years ago, I was asked to talk in the Western Regional State meeting of NA. And if you're not a drug addict, we NAs are different too. And in NA, tank top is formal dress. Okay? And this was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, over the 4th of July. And it was hot. And everybody's running around so comfortable, and I'm walking around in coat and tie. And I told them in my talk, when I dressed to please the world, when I tried to be the color the world wanted me to be, I knew pain. When I submit myself to the care of my sponsor, I know peace. I find the God that I need. The last thing my sponsor told me to do, and this will be, if I don't forget, it'll be a tie-up that I want to make that's very important for me. He told me about 2 years ago to do an inventory of my financial life and my sexual life. And I put that off for over a year, the longest I've ever delayed anything. And I've known probably one of the 10 lousiest sentences in AA literature for me is the one in the 12 and 12 that says, instincts on rampage, balk at investigation. That means when I'm letting my feelings run my life, I don't want to know it. I don't want to see it. And I hide myself from it. And I knew what was going on. And I knew there were problems that I did not want to see. I did exactly what he told me and got far more than I've ever dreamed. The fourth step tells me that I've got to know who I am today. I can't be the size of a tulip if I'm a dandelion. And I can look at people. I could look at Phyllis's glow and want to have her glow. But I'm not supposed to be Phyllis. I'm supposed to be Larry. And I'm not supposed to be her size. I'm supposed to be my size. And peace can only begin when I know the size I am today. And the fourth step is my inventorying where I'm at right now for my own program. Discovering when there's peace and when there's pain. And seeing exactly what's going on in my life. And I saw that my finances were out of control in this inventory. And I saw that I was having some addictive patterns in my sexual life that I was totally powerless over. And I didn't want to see them, and I didn't want to have them 21 years sober. But that was the size that I had at that moment. And the fifth step is the step of freedom. When I go to one person and tell them everything that I am, that gives me the freedom to bud. Doing it with one person eventually allows me to do it with everybody. I've gone to meetings hurting and said I'm fine. And I've walked home or driven home feeling worse because in the back of my mind what I said if they really knew. I've gone to meetings and told people how I hurt because that's where I was at. The program says we shared what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. Not what it's been like recently when it's been great, but what we are like now. And I owe that to you. I've had two people I sponsor call me on a Monday night and ask how you doing. I said, I'm thinking of killing myself. You don't like your sponsor to say that. I was about 15 years sober. But I owed them that. And because I had the freedom to let them know what I was feeling, the next day I had the deepest serenity I've ever had in AA. And the following Monday when they made their call again, you know, they didn't get the mortuary, they got me. And they knew that the program can walk through suicidal feelings. I continue to have them all through my 20 years. I started having them when I was a teen, about 12 years old. And it's just a form of symbolic escape for me, and I understand that today. And since I've closed off almost every other form of escape, my mind wants to run from pain. It'll think suicide and, you know, I won't die thinking it. And I just take the actions that I have. Now, if I hide those feelings from people, if I try not to blossom, I can't do it. There's a strain and a pain. And when I allow people to see the color that I'm at right now, I have the freedom to be me. And it's the start of deep peace. For most people, for me, the six steps that I would ask God to get rid of my anger. And then I would ask God to get rid of my greed. And then I would ask God to get rid of my dishonesty. And then I would ask God to get rid of my lust. It's an honest program, I gotta tell you. And what was left then would be what God would want. Now for me, I've discovered about 5 years ago, this is psychologically, biologically, and spiritually impossible. I believe there is something in the life that God has implanted in me that will never accept being less. That's dying. That ever wants to be more. And I have an entirely new concept of the sixth step. My God is a God of love. I found that God through you, through what you've done. Love is acceptance. And my God removes, not by my tearing away and getting rid of, but by allowing myself to be accepted where I am now. And when I come to an AA meeting and literally allow you to accept me fully, at that moment, my defects are lessened. They're pushed out. Let me give you an example of that. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. 5 years sober, I drove 140 miles to celebrate my 5th AA birthday. I was driving back at 11 o'clock at night. I had 3 packs of cigarettes in the car, 2 good lighters, was looking forward to smoking for the first time in my life. I had good lighters. 100 miles to drive, I pulled a cigarette out, and I heard God speak. I've heard people mock people who hear God speak, and it saddens me a little bit. Because just because I haven't experienced something doesn't mean you can't. And this is an area where I've heard my God. I couldn't tell you how, and it's unimportant for me to tell you how. I've never had a cigarette since. I went through no nicotine withdrawal. I didn't put a pound of weight on. I was already working this other program. And I don't smell smoke. Smoking doesn't offend me at all. I don't care. It's just there. What it was at that moment I was thanking God for 5 years of sobriety, and God was able just to fill me with love and push out a defect. And that's how my God does it. If I love who I am, I cannot abuse you sexually. If I have an experience of how rich God is with me, I cannot steal or cheat from you. I charge things to the church. I called it charging things I shouldn't. My sponsor called it stealing. My sponsor has a very poor grasp of the English language. If I understand how patient my God is with you, I can't be impatient with you. And all these things just go, those moments when I'm experiencing this love. The seventh step for me is so rich, and what I've got to share with it comes from a friend of mine in Oklahoma. I was chairing a meeting. We were on the seventh step. We had 3 minutes to go, and I said, "I'm sorry, I didn't call on you earlier, Harry." He said, "That's all the time I need," and he told this story. I'm going to tell it in my own terms. He said, "I had one tooth left that I really needed to enjoy a steak with, and I love a good steak, and the tooth wasn't feeling right, and I went to see a dentist. And that dentist looked in my mouth and he said, 'Harry, you got a defect of character. That tooth needs to be removed.'" And Harry said, "I loved the good steak so much I was not entirely ready to have that dentist remove that defect of character. So I said no thank you and went home." A little bit later, Harry got an infection in that tooth so that he felt his heartbeat in it. The next morning, he was in the dentist's office, entirely ready to have that dentist remove that defect of character. The dentist opened his mouth, took a look, closed his mouth, and said, "You have an infection. I can't pull that tooth. Take these pills and come back in 3 days. 3 days later, the tooth was still hurting. Harry opened his mouth. The dentist closed it, said, "Take these pills. Still infected. Come back in 3 days. 3 days later, the pain was gone, which is where Harry and I would part, because I wouldn't have gone back to the dentist. Harry did and had the tooth pulled. Why do I keep problems? Why did I keep a sexual problem after God removed a smoking problem? By the standards that I was taught, God should have reversed that completely. And yet I can hear my God telling me through those years, you have infections, spiritual infections, emotional infections connected with that. Take this meeting and come back in 3 days. And when this defect can be removed healthily, it's going to go just the way the smoking did." Now, if I'm going to be at peace in God's garden, I have to know if I have a right to be a dandelion, you have a right to be whoever you are. And this became very important for me today because I've walked through some problems and some pain. I did a spot check inventory, and I had self-pity, and I had anger, and I had fear, and I had anxiety. I had some calls that I had to make to the parish, and I normally I don't want to be there when I'm here because I like being me today. I like who I am. And I saw all these problems, and what I really discovered is I wasn't allowing others the freedom to be. And they can be themselves, but I'm going to be me. And I'm going to be the dandelion that God has called me to be and witness the way my God has called me to witness. And that includes my removing, and that's what the eighth step is. If I'm going to know that I hurt you, I have to know who you are. And the eighth step, I can't work until I have an understanding, a clue of the mystery of your being. I can know who I've abused and manipulated, who may get back at me, but to really know who I hurt, I have to know who is. And to know who is, first I must know who I am, and then I have to sense who you are and where you belong in God's garden and your right to be. And I have to be willing to remove that. And the 10th step is staying abreast of this. I want to go on to 11 and then tell you what's been happening recently. You see, the first 10 steps didn't help me to feel okay. They removed everything that kept me from feeling okay. But for me, it's meditation that allows me to do this. And my God is a God of love, so meditation more than truth. Meditation for me is not thinking, it's experiencing. And I'll give you two simple and then go on to one that ties in and start heading towards some of the little bit of how I want to wind up. The first simple meditation was my picturing myself as a scared child, 2.5 years old, with a very bad thunderstorm, and running and jumping in the arms of whatever loving authority figure I could picture. Now it's that woman who is a friend of my parents. And she puts her arms around me, and the storm is still there, and I'm somehow okay. And the reason that's my first picture is that's exactly what happened when I came to you. I was 35 years old with the emotional age of a 2.5-year-old. My first inventory showed that. And I was scared of hell, of the storms of life. And I came running and I jumped in your arms and you put your arms around me and it was okay, and yet the storm was there and I felt love. A little bit later, that meditation grew to my picturing. I have not had a child. If you had a child 2.5 years old and the child was born totally shriveled on the right side and 2.5 years old, you had just put that child to sleep. As your boy or girl was falling asleep, what would you have rubbed with the greatest tenderness and cried over with the warmest tears? That meditation taught me more than I had ever learned about God. I already knew a God who loved me, but that taught me more than I learned in the seminary, that meditation. I thought my God hated my defects. And that day I knew that for 56 years now, my God has rubbed with the greatest tenderness my defects and cried over them literally with his tears, because they see how his other children are going to laugh at me for having them, and how those defects will keep me from running free with his other children. Then I took the prayer of St. Francis that's in the 12 and 12. And it's, Lord, make me a channel of your peace. And I picture myself as a dandelion and God just at peace with me. He made me. That's what he wants me to be. That where there's hatred, I may sow. Now, the word your is not in all these, but it's necessary for me to be there because I can't love you if I don't have God loving me. That where there's hatred, I may sow your love. And I just feel this God of mine at such peace with his universe, wanting me, or her universe, wanting me to be a dandelion and at peace with me, loving me, accepting me as I am. That where there's despair, I may sow your faith. I got shocked when I understood my God had faith that I would be me. How could a dandelion bud and not be a dandelion? God knows I'm going to be Larry. And that's the essence of peace. That where there's doubt, I may sow your confidence. I could hear God laughing. I wonder what I'm going to be, how I'm going to develop, how I'm going to become Larry. Not what I'm going to do, but how I'm going to be. And my God knows that flower can't bud to be anything else, and it must bud, and it's going to bud, and I'm going to be Larry in his time and in his place. That where there's darkness, I may sow your light. The joy, the light God has, that dandelion is where it is, completing its place in the garden. And the last one that I felt is the last one in there, that where there's sadness, I may sow your joy. I need to experience the joy that my God has, that I'm in his plan, that I'm in his universe, and that I'm in his heart.
The 12th step talks about the joy of sharing with others. About 5 months ago, on a lark, I asked people in church to picture whatever scene, if there was one, that captured their God for them. And after about 2 minutes of silence, I shared mine. It's from the Bible. And if you don't believe in the Bible, please don't be offended, because I'm not going to use it to ram anything down your throat. I'm going to use it to explain why this is my God. It's a scene that happens at a meal when the Lord stands up and he sheds all of his dignity, all of his clothing, and puts a towel around his waist and gets a basin of water and he starts going and washing feet. And he gets to a friend who doesn't want him to do this, and the friend, he says, if I don't wash you, you can have no part of me. The reason that meditation is so powerful to me is that's how I became clean. I came to you, and unlike everybody else who shed their strength, you shed your weakness. You told me how you had failed. You told me how you had feared. Bill tells us in a footnote, and as Bill sees it, that up until the year 1952, he was still having severe depressions. Bill, our co-founder, who wrote the big book and had a blinding God experience, and he shed his dignity to give me that peace. You told me how you would abandon your families so that I could feel that when I hung up on suicidal people who called in the morning because I had to have a drink, that you understood and I was still okay, even though what I did wasn't. You shed your dignity and you washed me clean. And that's still the God that I experience in the program. I have a funny way that I show this. Supposing you were the only person you felt who had ever had sex with a shark. And you lived with this horrid pain for 20 years now. And you came to a meeting this big, and you finally blurted it out. I had sex with a shark. Over here, somebody would stand up and say, hammerhead off Miami 3 years ago. And you'd get a couple who'd stand up, groups with a great white Australian coral reef. Now that's funny. I'm going to tell you what I can't share from within, but the most sacred AA meetings I've been at 5 of them, I think. We've had a woman, brand new in the program, coming in crying because the courts have taken away her kids. And thank God at every one of these meetings, the men have said nothing and women have gone around. And they talk about aborting and what they walk through, having children, putting them up as orphans and what they walk through, keeping children, what they walk through, abusing children, what they walk through, all of these things. And it's just crying through the whole meeting, and nothing changes, and yet everything changes. We lay down our lives. We share what the rest of the world don't. We share our pain to heal others and wash them clean. And you gave me my dignity, and you helped me find my God. And I believe now as I go into the 12th step, that's what I'm to share with you. And in order for you to understand how maybe I can help some of you who are still hurting tonight, I need to tell you about the Oklahoma wheat. They planted in Oklahoma in October, and they start harvesting it about the first week of June. That's different from when they harvested in Nebraska, where Peggy is from, and I'm sure it's a different timetable than from when you harvested here. And if you went out to the fields of Oklahoma in December and January and February, you might know that right now, as they're almost at the end of the harvest, that wheat, where it's still unharvested, is about 3.5 feet tall. It's golden. It's headed out, and the fields are full. But in December and in January and February and March, those fields aren't gold. They're green. They're not 3.5 feet tall. They're about 3 inches tall. They're not headed out at all. But that wheat is precisely where it has to be to make it through an Oklahoma winter. If that wheat were 3.5 feet tall in November, it'd never take our winter winds. If it was headed out, it would rot before it was time to harvest. There's going to be a harvest because it depends upon the light, into the light. And I hope you see this as part of the theme, my budding and being free to becoming myself. I can look at you and see you've blossomed so quickly in sobriety, and yet it took me so long. But I'm a different strain of wheat, and I don't compete with you, and all I have to do is grow in God's plan. And I've cursed myself for being green, and I forgot, what the hell, it's just January. I've cursed myself for being short. And I forgot, what the hell, it's just February. I've cursed myself for not looking headed out the way I'm supposed to be in March. What the hell, it's just March. Now let me tell you what has happened in my sobriety. About 3 years sober, a nun taught me to hug myself. And it took a whole year because it felt like I was touching garbage. And I got the freedom to hug myself. I told you that I felt physically ugly. 12 years sober in Jonesboro, Arkansas, at a conference, someone closed a meeting by singing the Lord's Prayer, and I pictured my face for the first time in my life. Your love had allowed me to be who I was, first spiritually, then intellectually, then emotionally, and then physically. And if I had died that day, it would be enough. 5 years later, I was listening to my favorite speaker, Tom Eye, in Irving, Texas, and about 10 feet in front of me was a mirror, and I had trouble listening to him because I was flirting with my own looks. I'd gone from loving myself to liking myself, to liking the color that I had physically, and that was nearly impossible. I've told you how I've cried. I've learned to have my feelings. I've learned to laugh at times. I can be free. I still have a ways to go at times. Well, after I walked through a midlife crisis, I discovered, 10 years sober, I went through a midlife crisis. I felt like a failure, and I felt I was going nowhere. And the 11th and the 12th steps were the way out, because God willing, you'll all live long enough to go through it. And I want to tell you that, because I've never heard anybody else in AA say it. I felt I was a failure, and I felt that I was useless. And the 11th step tells me God loves me, and anyone that my God loves can't be a failure. And the 12th step tells me that if I'm alive today, someone out there in this group here needs my message. And if one person, if I can help one person escape the pain I walk through, my life isn't a failure. I have a purpose in living. And when I walked out of my midlife crisis, what I discovered is success is not doing, it's being. And if I am at peace to be Larry, I didn't know Phyllis. We sat across from each other at a dinner, and I've been electrified by the whole thing. Sitting up here, I just told her every speaker should have her sit next to him so she could look over with that light coming out of her eyes. She touches by who she is, and then the rest just proves it. And if I just can be me, then I can be free. And with that, I don't feel that I'm apart from the world anymore. I feel I belong. Being abandoned was the world abandoning me. Belonging is my accepting you. When I first spoke at NA, I was isolated at a conference and wondered why nobody accepted me till it occurred to me, that's a feeling in me. I'm not accepting them. I feel that because I'm basically AA and in a suit, they're all going to reject me. And I accepted the conference and I felt at home. I was asked to speak at a gay convention where they had straight and gay speakers. And the same thing happened until Saturday night I realized I was rejecting, and all I had to do was understand they had a right to be as I have a right to be, the whole conference, and I got over my fears and accepted them, and I was able to be me and had full peace. So I'm not abandoned if I accept you, not if you accept me. And that's within my power and within my peace. And I certainly have found my God. The God that washes me clean. I find his heart through you, and I found that God in every page of the Bible. When I was 2 years sober, at a young people's meeting, a biker stood up, and he read a portion of Jonathan Livingston Seagull, and it's what I close with. For many of you who are younger, you've never heard the story. Jonathan is a gull who dares to do what other gulls do, fly higher than everybody else. And he comes back, and he starts making some converts. And all of a sudden, Maynard is the one I want to tell you about. Maynard comes hobbling along the sand with a broken wing, and he looks at Jonathan, and Jonathan says, "What do you want?" And Maynard says, "I want to fly." And Jonathan says, "You can fly as high as you want to." And Maynard says, "I have a broken wing." And Jonathan says, "You can fly as high as you want to." A biker crying 19 years ago helped me cry even this year. But this story has been sacred to me because that's exactly how I came to you. I came to you not even able to crawl. Everything was broken. All those areas that I told you about. And you asked what I wanted. And I wanted to fly. And you looked at me and you said, "You can fly as high as you want to." And it's been slow. I've Think I took off later than others? I've flown lower than others, but one after another I've reached new plateaus. And if you're new here and you feel ugly, if you're new here and you feel you don't belong, if you're new here and you've been abandoned and you're afraid to commit yourself, if you're new here and you feel damned by life, damned by yourself, and you're damned by your God, I've had every one of those pains. Stay with us, because the simple message I have is you can fly as high as you want to. Thank you very much.